look routine. Can the Gales continue their incredible underdog run and dream the impossible dream? Or will the Golden Hawks send Queens crashing back to reality? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 12:45 p.m. for the Something in the Water pregame show ahead of the 1 p.m. kickoff.
Living in Kingston or nearby? Here's a hot tip for you. Rent your water heater from Utilities Kingston and support your community. When you rent from us, proceeds go towards local climate initiatives. With affordable monthly payments, no maintenance headaches, and quick service, renting just makes sense. Plus, we've got locally based technicians who respond fast, within 24 hours. Check out rent.utilitieskingston.com to switch today.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Kingston Economic Development Corporation and the Community Foundation for Kingston and Area have partnered up, launching a new workshop series designed specifically to help not-for-profit organizations tackle their unique challenges. The Community Foundation for Kingston and Area, also known as CFKA, plays a crucial role in supporting local nonprofits, pairing them up with interested donors and providing grant funding. CFKA has granted over $15 million to charities across KFLNA as of 2023. Kingston Economic Development is the sales and marketing arm for the City of Kingston, an entity focused on attracting new businesses, the growth and retention of existing business, and tourism opportunities. These organizations came together to create the Not-for-Profit Academy series after identifying a need for more resources for nonprofits in the Kingston area. With over 150 registered nonprofits in Kingston, these organizations make up a significant chunk of Kingston's economy. This afternoon, they will be kicking off the first workshop of the series, Strategic Communication Planning. The second will be Audience Mapping and Key Messages for Not-for-Profits, planned to run on November 13th. In the future, KED and CFKA are hoping to get feedback from participants and shape the rest of the series around the specific needs of Kingston's local nonprofits. I sat down with Stacey Kelly, Executive Director for Community Foundation for Kingston and Area, and Rob Tamblin, a Business Development Manager with Kingston Economic Development, to discuss the new series launching today. I was wondering if you'd like to just both introduce yourselves and your roles with this series.
So my name is Stacey Kelly, and I'm the Executive Director of the Community Foundation for Kingston and Area. And I guess I might call myself the instigator of this idea, but I knew that in order for it to flourish, you wanted to have a partner. And so we reached out to our wonderful friends at Kingston Economic Development Corporation.
And I'm Rob Tamblin. I'm a business development manager for the Kingston Economic Development Corporation. And I think I'd echo Stacey's thoughts. I think we certainly had heard from, organizations within the community about lacking some resources and whatnot in the not-for-profit sector. So when Stacey approached us, it was like, yes, this makes total sense. Let's do it.
Stacey, you mentioned there you were the instigator of this project. What sort of sparked the interest in starting the series?
When I returned to Kingston in August 2022 to take on this role, I did what I've been sort of calling my rediscovery tour of Kingston and meeting with a bunch of staff, leaders, and program folks from a variety of the agencies that we fund across the city. And it came really obvious to me that there were some challenges and gaps in both capacity and resources that our agency partners were facing. And that led me to think that as wonderful it is that we are a granting organization and provide funding through grants, it's not the only way we can support addressing some of these issues and gaps and opportunities for collaboration for these wonderful agencies. And so it occurred to me that perhaps there was support beyond granting that we really should be thinking about creating to address the needs of our community partners.
Awesome. And Rob, what did you think when Stacey came to you with this idea?
Well, as I said, I think, we certainly, we're in touch with a number of different organizations within the Kingston business community. When people think economic development, they always think for profit, but that certainly isn't always the case. We had heard about, challenges that those in the not-for-profit sector are facing, and it seemed to be some commonalities. So, as I said, when Stacey chatted with us, we thought, well, this would be a perfect thing to partner in and launch.
Great. And we'll dive a bit more into the details in a minute, but what is the Not-for-Profit Academy series for folks who have never heard of it before?
Well, what we're trying to do is, this is really the kickoff because we anticipate having more. One of the first sort of gaps that we noticed that people had is there's a lot of not-for-profits that don't have dedicated marketing communication staff, for example. And so we thought this would be maybe a nice, easy and early kind of win and sort of, we want to provide value, right? So we reached out to some experts in the city to help develop the first two opening sessions for this academy. So the first is around strategic communication planning, which is in October 30th. And then in November 14th, it's sort of almost like, think of it like, if you're in school during the prerequisites, it's not required, but I think it's sort of part two, a little bit more in depth. It's around audience mapping and key messaging for nonprofits. So really sort of building on the fundamental knowledge of the first session. But of course, you can register for both. You can register for one and however. And what we want to do with that is then, survey our participants and understand more about what other types of topics they'd like to hear from us. Where are those knowledge gaps that we could help them develop in terms of their capacity for their organizations?
It sounds like you're going to do some digging to find out exactly what folks in the nonprofit sector are looking for. But starting off, how are these workshops going to differ from other business-oriented workshops? What are some of those things that differentiate nonprofits from other kinds of businesses that cause them to require this unique approach?
Well, I mean, I guess from our perspective, most of the workshops that we run are targeted specifically to businesses who either have a product or service to sell to, their target market. So there's a certain way to do that. And quite often would be an easier thing to do than when you're looking at the audience that a not-for-profit targets. So I think that there's some subtle nuances and some differences that make it a really unique learning opportunity. So that's what we're really trying to do with the two sessions coming up on marketing is really look at it from the vision of these organizations in the not-for-profit sector, because they certainly face unique challenges that for-profit companies don't.
Yeah. And Stacey, did you have anything on that?
Oh, I love what Rob said. And I agree. I think just to build on that, the key differentiator here is that our two presenters, the co-leads who developed these two courses, have develop it from that perspective, as Rob was saying, of the not-for-profit organization, which has slightly different levers, slightly different North Star than the for-profit. While there are similarities in terms of we are all enterprises, the key differentiator there being, as Rob was alluding, is a slightly different sort of pivot around what are the different levers we have in terms of marketing ourselves, what are the levers for raising revenues? Traditionally, right, we don't have sort of a product array. How do we differentiate ourselves even within our own market amongst other nonprofits and around that sort of audience, understanding who our audiences are, what's the right messaging to build for those audiences, to build build an audience, build and inspire and engage around the cause and our mission.
Yeah, for sure. And Rob, you mentioned right off the top that maybe not-for-profits isn't immediately what people are thinking about when they think Kingston Economic Development. I was wondering if you could both dive a bit deeper into the importance of supporting our not-for-profits and providing series like this, even though it might not be immediately what people think of when they think Kingston Economic Development.
Yeah, I think for us, I think that the stat in Kingston is there's over 150 registered not-for-profits in the city. So certainly, they have a huge impact on the overall economic activity in the greater Kingston area. And that's not just in terms of the number of people that they employ, but the number of goods and services that they buy within the community. I mean, to be honest, I think that it's also growing, right? So I think recognizing that and doing something that's specifically for them will go a long way to helping that sector.
Yeah, for sure. And Stacey, did you have anything on that?
Well, yeah, and thank you very much, Rob, for providing that local piece. Certainly, I have at my hands, the Ontario sector. It may shock people to know that there's 58,000 nonprofits and charities in Ontario alone, who employ just under 900,000 people, and contributed just shy of 8% to the province's GDP. That's like $65 billion in economic impact. That is a huge sector. I think people often, in the news or cocktail parties, only think about the large, maybe more potentially, quote, sexy, for profit. But the reality is it's a massive sector that makes a huge impact, to Rob's point, on our local economies, our provincial economies, and, of course, at the national scale. So there's a lot of charities doing great work. And we're all still in that post-pandemic recovery phase. And there are challenges for the sector. There are headwinds in the sector. And so what we're trying to understand from the local context as a community foundation is, what are those particular pressure points and stressors on our organizations, and what role can and should we play to help bolster our partners across the region? And in this case, again, it's we don't have unlimited financial resources, so part of the thinking was, okay, well, in addition to the granting that we do annually, what can we do to help support? And again, from the need, understanding the needs of our organizations and where we think we can provide value.
Once again, that was Stacey Kelly with Community Foundation for Kingston and Area, and Rob Tamblyn with Kingston Economic Development on the Not-for-Profit Academy workshop series kicking off this afternoon, and to be continued with more sessions planned in the future. Workshops are being held virtually, and registration can be completed online at investkingston.ca/events. In a message directly from the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, improving home energy efficiency with sustainable Kingston. The Kingston Frontenac Public Library's One Earth Climate Series, in partnership with Sustainable Kingston, takes a deep dive into topics relating to climate, sustainability, and energy efficiency. Presentations given by energy professionals from Sustainable Kingston and a representative of Little Forest Kingston provide suggestions on how to save money on home utility and repair costs while having a positive impact on the environment. This series covers a wide range of topics, including modifying basements and foundation energy upgrades, attics and heat installation, home retrofitting, reimagining urban lawns as pocket meadows and forests, and the Better Homes Kingston program. Olivia Camforest, librarian at the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, states, quote, "Many routine practices of powering, heating, cooling, and landscaping around our homes are detrimental to the environment. There is no time quite like the present, and therefore no better time to make small changes within our homes that yield positive environmental outcomes. There are many ways to make a difference, even transforming an urban grass lawn into an oasis for wildlife and pollinators, where wildflowers, trees, and shrubs are allowed to grow undisturbed, will have a tremendous impact." Join KFPL and Sustainable Kingston on Monday evenings from 6 to 7:30 p.m. until November 26th. This is a drop-in program, and admission will be on a first-come, first-served basis. The location of each date varies among KFPL branches and the Kingston East and Rideau Heights Community Centers. For more information and the location of each session, you can visit the Kingston Frontenac Public Library website. Finishing off tonight, we have a quick note from the City of Kingston. The Name Our Plow campaign is back this year, and the city's Public Works Department is looking for your fun and imaginative names to put on the side of one of its snow plows. Submit your cool, creative, and Kingston-specific plow names at Get Involved Kingston, and you can be seeing it on a Kingston plow this winter. Submissions will be accepted from October 28th at 12 p.m. until November 12th at 4 p.m., at which point the city will select a short list of names. The community will have the opportunity to vote on their favorite snowplow name from November 18th to November 25th on Get Involved Kingston. The winning name will be revealed on December 9th. The 2023 Name Our Plow campaign garnered more than 400 name submissions. Murney Plower joined the fleet after receiving the most votes from the public. Snowplowing is serious business in Kingston. We work continuously in the winter to plow more than 1,800 kilometers of road lanes and 600 kilometers of sidewalks. Learn more about winter maintenance at cityofkingston.ca/snow. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Isabella with your CFRC Sports Report.
Hello and welcome to the CFRC Sports Desk. I'm Isabella Garrido, your CFRC Sports Reporter, bringing you the latest athletics updates. Let's kick things off with women's hockey, where the Gales will face the Windsor Lancers on November 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Memorial Center. Recently, the Gales faced a tough battle against the Waterloo Warriors, where they just fell short, losing 3-2. Despite dominating stretches of play, they couldn't close the gap in the final minutes. The Gales generated quality scoring chances early on, but it was Waterloo's Erica Porter who struck first. However, Queens responded strongly with goals from Allison Reeves and Taya Leonard, giving them a brief lead. Unfortunately, Waterloo capitalized on a penalty, allowing Porter to score again and eventually clinch the game. Queens outshot Waterloo 32-27, showing their potential to break through in upcoming matches. With their current record at 1-4, they are looking to bounce back against Windsor and bring home a victory. Switching gears to basketball, the men's team is coming off of an impressive season opener, securing a 97-81 road win against the Guelph Griffins. Despite trailing early, the Gales rallied in the second quarter and never looked back. First-year player Ollie Engine made a remarkable debut, leading the team with 23 points and 5 rebounds. Lucas Silas also had a strong performance with 21 points. The team shot 48% from the floor and is heading into their home opener against the Windsor Lancers on November 1st at 8 p.m. at the Arc. The women's basketball team, however, had a challenging start to their season, falling 83-54 against Guelph in their opener. The first quarter was competitive, but a tough second quarter, where they were outscored 29-11, set the tone for the game. Haley Barbieri led the Gales with 17 points, while Michaela McFarland chipped in with a 10. Queens shot just 30% from the floor and will need to improve their shooting percentage if they want to find success against Windsor, also on November 1st at 6 p.m. Both basketball teams will be looking for strong performances as they head into these matchups. The pressure is on to turn their season around, especially for the women after their tough loss. Queens fans will surely pack the Arc to support both teams during this doubleheader against Windsor. Looking ahead, it's crucial for both these teams to find their rhythm early on in the season. With plenty of games ahead, the Gales are hoping to build these experiences and improve their standings in the OUA. That's a wrap for our sports updates today. This has been Isabella Garrido with your CFRC Sports Desk. Now back to Christina Laurie with your weather report for this evening.
Thank you, Isabella. This is Christina coming in with your CFRC weather report for this evening. Tonight, we're expecting a few clouds with winds being 20 kilometers per hour, gusting to 40 and becoming light late this evening. We have a low of 14 degrees. Looking forward to tomorrow, Thursday, October 31st, we're expecting sunny skies. We'll have increasing cloudiness early in the afternoon. Winds will be 30 kilometers per hour in the morning. We have a high of 21 degrees and a UV index of 3 or moderate. Thursday night, we'll have cloudy skies with a 60% chance of showers and a low of 9. On Friday, November 1st, we're expecting cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers and a high of 11 degrees. Friday night, clear skies with a low of minus 3. Getting into the weekend on Saturday, November 2nd, we'll have sunny skies with a high of 9, and Saturday night, clear skies with a low of plus 3. Finishing off the week on Sunday, November 3rd, we'll have a mix of sun and cloud with a 40% chance of showers and a high of 12 degrees. Sunday night, cloudy skies with a low of 6. That wraps up your quick weather report for this evening, and next up is your CFRC traffic report with Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your weekly traffic report from October 27th to October 31st, 2024. Pavement rehabilitations will take place along Highway 401 between Westbrook Road to beyond the Highway 15 overpass and on the Sir John A. McDonald overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Highway 401 eastbound at Highway 15 will have a full mainline closure October 27th and October 28th, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. for both days. Highway 401 westbound at Highway 15 will have full mainline closures October 27th through 31st, 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. for each of those days. And now the road closures for the week. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Collingwood Street, Earl de Union is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th is closed until October 31st for buried infrastructure replacement. The road will be open to local traffic, however. Kings Court Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick is closed until November 15th to accommodate a water main replacement. Union Street, Willingdon to Albert is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. University Avenue, Union to Earl is closed for construction related to the Queen's J-Duck project. Waterside Way, Scarlet to Schooner is closed October 30th to October 31st to accommodate roadway painting. Wellington Street, Main to George is closed until October 30th to accommodate construction-related activity for the Berryfield Highlands subdivision project. Other delays you can expect to see this week. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bay Ridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor begins phase 2 of the Bay Ridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles slash Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Creekford and Centennial, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. And Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard at Elmwood, expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
Now it's time for your CFRC Community Events Calendar. Have an event in Kingston that you'd like covered on our website and news programming? Contact us today at cfrc.ca. Starting off today on Monday, October 28th, Brass and One Eye Jacks are hosting their weekly trivia game starting at 7 and 7:45 p.m. respectively. Also tonight, head over to Kingston Penn to enjoy Pumpkin Inferno from 7:15 to 8:45 p.m. Tickets are $21. On Tuesday, October 29th, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. You can also grab your runners and head over to Lululemon downtown at 5:30 p.m. for a weekly fun run. The run is for all ages and abilities. Later on Tuesday night, Daft Brewing is hosting a Euchre Night starting at 7 p.m. Folks can also enjoy Terror Tuesday at Fort Henry with a screening of the horror film Us. Tickets are $15 and the show starts at 8 p.m. On Wednesday, October 30th, head over to the Rideau Heights Community Center for the Fresh Food Pop-Up Market featuring fresh, healthy, and affordable food options between 2 and 5 p.m. Kingston Community Health Centers is also hosting a Flinton-friendly craft session from 9:30 a.m. till noon. This is a drop-in opportunity to meet friends and craft away. On Wednesday night, Something in the Water Brewing and Daft Brewing will host their trivia night starting at 7 p.m. And One Eye Jacks will host North End Board Games Night for free, also starting at 7. If you're looking to get festive on Thursday, October 31st, starting at 7:15, folks can enjoy Dark Night at Fort Bright. Enjoy scary attractions with costumed actors and your friends or family. Tickets are $30. Folks can also enjoy the Halloween Parade starting at Skeleton Park, a family-friendly event starting at 4:30. Daft Brewing is hosting the Turnout Halloween Drag Show and Dance Party starting at 7 p.m. Tickets are $30 at the door. On Friday, November 1st, the YMCA will host its weekly fresh food market from 9:30 to 12:30. A great opportunity to get fresh food at great prices. Also on Friday, head out to Lemoyne Point for an autumn forest therapy walk led by Stana Luxford Audie starting at 11:30 a.m. On Saturday, November 2nd, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Finishing off the week on Sunday, November 3rd, get up early and head over to Runner's Choice for an early morning long run starting at 8:30 a.m. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 2 p.m. featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. Next up is Noah with your CFRC concerts calendar for this week.
And now it's time for the CFRC concerts calendar for this week. On Monday evening, check out Inner Harbor Jazz live at the RCHA starting at 4:30 p.m. Admission is $5. You can also see Kentucky undertaking a musical residency at the Cove Inn from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Admission is available by donation. On Tuesday evening, head over to the RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. for another great edition of Weekly Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam, a free event. Also on Tuesday, you can go see Henry Norwood live at the Cove Inn from 6 to 9 p.m. Alice in the World We Live In will also be live at the Kingston Grand Theater Tuesday through Thursday at 7:30 p.m. each night. Ticket information can be found at kingstongrand.ca. On Wednesday, take a ride on the Wolf Island Ferry and pop by Open Mic Night with Mike Rapkins at Hotel Wolf Island, a free showing starting at 7 p.m. You can also head out to the Cove Inn from 5:30 to 8:30 for wings and tunes on the patio. On Halloween, folks can head out to see Beats Workin' performing at the RCHA from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Also on Thursday, Lucanus returns with The Man from Hell, performing live at the Musiki Cafe from 8 to 11 p.m. Admission is free. Don't miss the All Hallows Eve Electric Shakedown at the Toucan, running from 9:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. Doors open at 8, admission is free, featuring local acts like Strange Happenings, The Mature Themes, and Arachnia. You can also head over to the mansion for a rocking good time with Cassador, Carnelian, Squid Pistol, Is Bister, Roses and Revst, with DJ Devious in the Wine Cellar. $1,000 cash prize for the best costume. Doors at 8, bands at 9. Tickets are $15 in advance, $20 at the door. On Friday, don't forget to stop in for free karaoke at The Buckle starting at 9 p.m. Lucas Oak will be performing at Royal Tavern 2.0, 5 to 7 p.m. as well on Friday evening. Admission is free. Also on Friday, SOS, the ABBA Experience, will be live at The Spire starting at 7:30 p.m. For ticket information, visit thespirekingston.org. The Celtic Kitchen Party will play live at Tiernan Oak Irish Pub. Admission is free. The show runs from 9 p.m. to midnight. On Saturday, Sarah Sagal Lazar will be live at Hotel Wolf Island from 8:30 to 11 p.m. Also on Saturday, Head Over Heels will be live at the Cove Inn from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Justin Sleeth and Jack Baker will also perform live music at the Creekside Bar and Grill from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Also on Saturday, Soulish Fall Tour with Lost Faculty, the Third Street Band, and ChatGPT will perform at the Mansion from 8 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. James Vincent McMorrow will be live at the Broom Factory. The show starts at 7:30 p.m. On Sunday, the Gertrudes will be live at the Broom Factory. The show starts at 3:30 p.m., and admission is pay what you can. Also on Sunday, Harmon in Space will take place live at the Grand Theater. This family-friendly show runs from 2:30 to 4 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $15 for students, and $10 for children. The McMillan's Camp Boys will be performing live at the Cove Inn from 1 to 4 p.m., and you can stick around for Eric and Megan taking the stage from 5 to 8 p.m. Have a concert you'd like listed on CFRC's website and announced on our airwaves? Reach out on our website contact page at cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Help CFRC serve our community listeners. Have your voice heard and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smoke's Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Kerutas Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca.
Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Chris Roth. Today we will hear a discussion on the topic, Valuing Nature's Assets. This program was produced and distributed by World Economic Forum. Before that, here are a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across 5 regions of the country, BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and on Twitter at CFRC.
Welcome to everyone tuning in. We are here to discuss one of the most important topics here at the UN General Assembly in the margins of New York Climate Week on valuing nature's assets. Now, with mounting environmental degradation and loss of biodiversity, there's probably no topic more critical than the one that we'll be here to discuss. We know that more than half of global GDP, that amounts to $44 trillion, derives directly from nature and its natural resources. And so in recognition of this, the global community has already come together under the Kunming Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework to establish a goal to halt and reverse biodiversity and nature loss by 2030, but we know we have such a long way to go. In particular, the private sector is going to be responsible for delivering more than 80% of the climate and nature finance necessary to decarbonize our economy and protect and restore nature. And so what we're here to discuss in particular is what is the important and critical role of businesses, and how do we create the right business case and the right justification for the private sector to step up to the challenge. This conversation is also inspired by a WEF report. We'll put up a link into the QR code so that you can download it. It's Spotlight on Nature, Case Studies for Business, Transformation Towards a Nature Positive Future. We invite you to download this report and learn more about the topic following this conversation. Also, please tweet or post on social media any of the reactions that you might have to the conversation or additional perspectives using hashtag SDIM24. So without further ado, I am delighted and honored to be with an expert panel to lend their perspectives to this topic and see what progress we might be able to make through dialogue, conversation, and collaboration. So first, we have Eric Usher, who is the head of the United Nations Environment Program Finance Initiative. Welcome, Eric. We have Kathleen McLaughlin, who is the president of the Walmart Foundation and EVP and Chief Sustainability Officer at Walmart. Welcome. Christian Teleki, who is the CEO of Fauna and Flora International. And last but certainly not least, welcome Ndidi Nwaneli, who is the president of the One Campaign. So let me start by just asking a framing question to all of you. I've framed some of the importance of nature, but also the challenge ahead. What do you think are the right reasons, or what are the right what trends are you seeing in terms of the private sector actually making meaningful investments in nature? Is it something that's relegated to corporate social responsibility? Is it more of a charity, or are you seeing it actually integrated into the business and the balance sheet across the private sector? Eric, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, thank you, and pleasure to be here. I will speak from the perspective of the finance sector. That's what we work with, so banking, insurance, investment and financial services. And nature, in many ways, it was the first issue that the private sector would look at. And then over the years, climate, there was a lot of concentration there, which is in many ways a subset of the nature issue. What we're seeing now, and there's been a lot of progress on climate from the private sector, starting on disclosing, on being clear on where the risks are in terms of your business and your portfolio, to then starting to act on it in terms of how do we contribute to, let's say, decarbonization, the net zero objective. Nature is a wider issue. In some ways it's quite complicated, but there are parallels. And typically how a bank, like a corporation, would look is at start, it's do no harm. How do we understand where the risks are? And there's been a lot of awareness raising, a lot of frameworks about how we can start to be transparent to our stakeholders about whether we are doing business practice or financing business practice, which is going to do material harm. So good progress there. Where we're really at the nexus right now, where the takeoff point, the report you've released, is this notion of nature positive. And that's why I'm very excited to be here today to talk about that. What's the role of the finance sector in helping drive positive outcomes within the nature realm?
Yeah, really important to not just have a do no harm approach, but also proactively pursue the regeneration and restoration of nature to Absolutely. Give back. So we'll pick up on that topic a bit more. But Kathleen, could you share Walmart's perspective? Walmart has been a vanguard in the sustainability realm, but of course is in the position of having to balance sustainability outcomes with performance metrics at the corporate level. What is Walmart's position, and have you seen the ability to justify investments in sustainability while delivering performance?
Yeah. Well, to answer your first question, I think there's integration more than ever before. And as a society, we're in the middle of a significant transition that is really affecting every system, transportation systems, material systems, food systems, of course, climate, but many other factors that relate to how we live in harmony or not with the natural world. And so I would say that sustainability isn't really a separate thing. You know, if it was maybe 10 years ago, it's not now. It's quite integrated. So for example, for a retailer, a very relevant issue for us is the resilience of the supply chains that produce the ingredients or sometimes even the finished product of our assortment. So whether that is rice or beef or salmon or cotton, you know, you can pick any of those. The business case is embedded. So it's not sustainability over here and then let's talk about how we're going to source these commodities. It's what's the approach to sourcing commodities that will ensure surety of supply for the long term. So we need resilience of those supply chains in the face of climate. That is the most efficient way to produce those commodities. And so there's often cost savings in that. Or to your point, opportunity to create new products that are of interest to customers, but also sustain the economies and livelihoods of producing regions. So we can perhaps get into some of those examples this morning.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. Christian, you're the CEO of a major biodiversity conservation nonprofit. What has been your experience working with businesses and understanding their motivations and their incentives to invest in these projects on the local level?
Well, the good news is that I think it's a really exciting time in terms of nature. I mean, people are more environmentally conscious than they have been ever before. You know, it's front of mind, and we're seeing that. I think the bad news is that we're not moving with the speed and scale that's going to be required of the changes, and I think we need to accelerate that. And so we're, you know, I think there are conversations being held with some businesses. Walmart is a great example of a business that is really leading the way and really thinking about this. My worry is that there are a whole bunch of range of other businesses that are probably saying the right things and publicly, but privately not sure where to go and how to take that forward. And so there's a challenge there, but therein lies an opportunity in order to move that along. I would say the other, you know, two dimensions of that is just finance. We as an organization are dealing exclusively local and community-based organizations, and they are on the front line of biodiversity loss and climate change. And if we don't get those resources and the finance there, you know, we're not going to win that battle. And I think the third thing I would say, and this is more of a plea to businesses, is to think about people and nature, mm-hmm. not or. And people and nature, mm-hmm. climate and nature. We're putting that together in the same bucket, because that is where, by bringing this together, breaking down the silos between historically, you know, health, climate, nature, food systems, have often been treated in silos, and we need to bring those together. So I think great opportunity, but we need a little bit more work to do.
Yeah, thank you, Christian. Mm-hmm. The One Campaign, could you tell us a little bit about what your perspective is on inspiring communities, individuals, investors to really recognize the importance of nature and resource, its protection and restoration?
Thanks so much, and it's really a pleasure to be here with you. I would say that through our lens, we fight for investments that ensure healthy lives and economic opportunity in Africa. And we've seen the brunt of climate on many of our businesses on the continent, supply chains, food ecosystems, healthcare, because food is medicine and the declining access to affordable, nutritious food. And I'm excited to see a lot of the rhetoric in the ecosystem, but what we're not seeing is the financing to back it up. And we're not seeing enough support for small and medium-sized enterprises, which are really the bedrock of many of our emerging economies. These small and medium-sized enterprises are being held to very high standards when it comes to climate, the new emerging standards of emissions and, you know, water management and soil management. Farmers are very affected, right, by these new standards. But there's not enough support for them to make that transition, even to capture the data to enable them to benefit from the gains. And unfortunately, many of the big businesses, and I know Walmart is an exception, I hope, but many of the big businesses are not investing in supporting the supply chain to actually meet those same standards. And so what we push for at the One Campaign is really equity and justice. And I would love to see those words beyond people and businesses transition through the entire supply chain from farmers in the most struck countries by the climate disasters to the logistics providers, the primary processors, the women, business owners, all the way up, and to enable all of us to transition together at the same pace and leave no one behind.
Yeah, so you all touched on such important dimensions of the topic. I think, are you seeing a degree of standardization across industry, right? So rather than just these actions being voluntary, are we seeing the bar being raised through protocols, frameworks, even peer groups that are going to push a race to the top? Or are we still seeing a lot of businesses in a bit of a holding pattern, waiting to see until regulation unfolds, and until then, it's just the leading businesses like Walmart and your peers that are leading the way? How do you all see this coming together?
I think one of the most exciting things does go back to the point you raised at the beginning about integration.
And people see the business case, the business need to invest in nature and in ways that elevate people who are working in supply chains or in communities. And there's been so much momentum and action because of that. Set aside regulation or policy, or whatever. We need that too, for sure. But I'll just give a couple examples. So one is a platform we started initially to address climate that we call Project Gigaton. But more and more, that platform has supported action for nature, for people, you know, for regenerative agriculture, for forests, and so on, in supply chains. And we've had almost 6,000 suppliers now engaging in that. We ask our suppliers, big and small, to set a target that's within their business requirements, their wherewithal, and then we provide training and tools to access third-party providers or know-how or so on to share best practice across. And we really focus on the business case and how it can be relevant for a small producer as well as a large. And we encourage the large ones to help the small ones in, you know, practice groups and so on. And to date, we've hit our emissions reduction goal early, 6 years early. Those suppliers delivered a gigaton of emissions improvement already. We're going to keep going. So that's one way we're trying to reach the SMEs, the small and medium producers. And because we're a global company, we're operating this in places like India, different countries in Africa through Massmart, our business there, and so on. That's one. The second way that I think you see big companies reaching through the supply chain to producing communities and helping smallholders is work people are doing on smallholders in the food system. Most of the larger food companies, and certainly Walmart, have pretty significant initiatives working back with people who are producing, sometimes for markets, sometimes for their own consumption. And it's everything from okra to mint to, you know, millet in India and so on. And the goal is to help those farmers improve their livelihoods and their sustainability while adopting practices that are better for the planet in their local, you know, community. So it's market access, advice on processing, investment in value-added processing, and so on. And many of them are earmarking or focusing on how to remove barriers mm-hmm. to help women. Mm-hmm. You know, so in India, we've been working on this for a while, and we've touched 800,000 farmers. We've added a goal for another million, half of whom we hope will be women, and we're working with local organizations supporting them on the ground, you know, to achieve this, because the vision is one where they're sustained, they're thriving, you know, that we need them. They're producing a huge amount of the food in the world, and they also are accountable for many of the world's jobs. How to make them life-sustaining, you know, jobs is what we're trying to work on.
I'd love to pick up on that. I think certainly from our perspective, this enabling and sharing the art of possible mm-hmm. at the small scale is absolutely fundamental. You know, seeing is believing, showing these solutions on the ground. We work in an island in the middle of Lake Nicaragua, mm-hmm. Ometepe Island. Mm-hmm. And there, on this island, is the last refuge of the yellow-nape parrot, most highly traded parrot species globally, beautiful parrot. Now you're sitting there thinking, okay, where is he going with this? How is this connecting to the discussion? Well, it turns out that this parrot lives in a particular type of trees. Mm-hmm. And we worked with the local communities to protect these trees mm-hmm. So that the parrot could thrive. But then the farmers adjacent said, well, wait a second. Maybe we shouldn't be cutting down these trees. Maybe actually we should be trying to, you know, have integrated agriculture approaches mm-hmm. so that we, you know, we're fostering this general community about awareness about environment and species. In 2 years, that led to an 85% reduction in burning of the forest and a 100% increase in money in their pockets. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very small scale, but what it demonstrates, mm-hmm. it demonstrates that this is possible. And if you start adding that up, connecting to ecosystems mm-hmm. like yours, you know, we can really be catalytic in making progress.
Yeah. And just to build on that, so I think there are two perspectives. One is we need training and support to provide the incentives for small businesses to come up. And through my work in my previous life as an ag and food entrepreneur, I started African Food Changemakers, and we actually incorporated an initiative called BRACE to empower entrepreneurs in 40 African countries to make that transition. Mm-hmm. Now, but what we noticed mm-hmm. is that, in principle, if governments don't set policies, mm-hmm. then bad behavior or good behavior is not either fostered or encouraged.
And so you have double standards. Mm. And unless there are financial incentives and supports, it's rhetoric in the ecosystem. And through my work and on many boards of global companies, I have seen companies say, well, in Nigeria, I can get away with it. So I'm not going to bother making the investments. It's too costly. But I can't get away with it in England. You know what I mean? And so what I want to push for on platforms like this is the importance of not having double standards and not valuing one life or one region over another. If you've set a global standard, implement it across the world. Inspire others to raise their standards and hopefully work with governments where possible to also set minimum standards of best behavior. Because it's not a choice anymore. It affects us on a daily basis, and the choices we choose, either we choose to be good and better, or we choose to be mediocre, or to value life differently. And this comes back to your point on nature and people and human lives being equally valuable, regardless of where you operate.
I want to come in on that and just emphasize that. It is so true. I mean, humanity has gone through many transitions in human history, right? Like there are all kinds of transitions. What's different this time is it's deliberate and intentional. We're all thinking about it and working on it together, and we're running against time. There is a time-bound element. So what makes it really challenging is we're talking about really complex systems to shift. And there's only so far that we can go through innovation and each party playing its part within its own rule set. We got to look at the rules.
Yep.
And so policy is so important, you know, especially for things like preventing deforestation or conversion of critical landscapes or what's happening in oceans and so on. We need it. And being aware that the transitions for climate and for nature need to be bringing people along. So the people in these regions who are producing, how do they make choices that can still feed their family, but also protect nature and so on? And so there's a lot of innovation going on. And one thing I want to just come back to is your point about the parrots in Nicaragua. That example is so great. One of the most exciting things that I think has happened is the emergence of these so-called place-based models, right, that integrate conservation goals, restoration goals, and production of commodities or some other form of economic activity for people who live in those regions in balance. And when the Nature COP met in Montreal and they agreed to the 30 by 30 kind of target and so on, this notion of other effective conservation measures, this recognition that you could have a territory that's, you know, occupied by indigenous peoples and they're working the land, that could still be a form of conservation with certain safeguards. And then what can we do to help elevate, you know, the livelihoods of those people? And, you know, one example is the Marshall Islands, the Republic of Marshall Islands, where, you know, they've been participating in the fishery, they get some revenue and stuff, but they weren't really, it wasn't their part of their industry. And so the government said, you know what, we should have our own fishery and we can operate it at a really high standard in terms of environmental safeguards and people. So they did this. They worked with Nature Conservancy and others to kind of create this company called Pacific Island Tuna. And that tuna company aims to not only adhere to MSC, Marine Stewardship Council standards, but beyond that in terms of bycatch and overfishing and all these sorts of things, dockside unloading, et cetera, but creating livelihoods for people of the Marshall Islands to participate in a different way in that fishery. And obviously with safeguards against some of the issues like forced labor and so on at the high seas, because the way they're doing it, and earmarking 40% of the net income from that company for coastal restoration, which then again helps the country in terms of tourism and all these things. So it's a great example of conservation, restoration, economic activity. And that's kind of how we're coming at it, is to say, all right, what are the commodities in our chain that are most reliant on nature and also at risk? And then can we work with others at source to do this? We need policy. Some of these we've gone as far as we can. And to your point, we can do all kind of great stuff here, but next door they're chopping down the forest. So that is a limiting factor.
Yeah, because you have leakage issues potentially. Yeah.
The system certainly does. Yeah. We can do all kind of great things, but somebody else comes along over here, right? So how do we get it?
Yeah, how do we get a degree of scale and normalization? Mm-hmm. Eric, what is your perspective on policy and regulation and financial instruments that you're seeing being deployed towards these solutions?
I mean, I think where we need to go is you have a lot of long history of knowledge, particularly in the conservation space,
yeah.
even in financing conservation, and the private sector has been a part of that, but often typically as a side activity.
Yeah.
And I guess the question, and mm-hmm. coming to your comments like from Walmart, is mm-hmm. how do you rather than seeing it as an add-on, it's
right.
really about not supporting another activity, it's what about my business?
Mm-hmm. It's part of the sourcing strategy.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. to say how does it reflect? And for a bank, for you know, the loans we provide through our loan book or our investment portfolio, it's not simply about just abiding by the law. It's actually understanding what are we financing? What are the impacts of what we are financing, the positives mm-hmm. and the negatives, and how can we drive that? And so it requires holistic thinking about this. You started at the beginning, you said, you know, is this corporate philanthropy? I think managers would say, okay, maybe there's some innovations that need to be done, and that's the role of corporate philanthropy. But unless we can then drive into the mainstream business strategy, into the corporate governance of the organization, unless there's alignment in terms of you know how people are paid their bonuses, or do they see incentive in that they feel that a purpose-driven organization, this is really what the organization should be doing as a whole, not as a sidecar, then you're starting to talk about change. And I think we see progress in that direction. I think it then comes to the question of, you can get, and Paul Pullman, for example, would like to talk about, you know, to say that we have 30 or 50% of industry on board, but the problem is the other 50%, mm-hmm. and what do you do about them? And that's absolutely where regulation and policymakers are needed. Mm-hmm. The question a little bit is, some will say, whatever the private sector does, is it important? We need policies, and our belief is that it's very hard to get policies unless part of the private sector is leaning in. Mm-hmm. The leadership mm-hmm. and the knowledge of how to do it, at least a good part of it, mm-hmm. is going to come from the private sector. A lot of it's going to come from the mm-hmm. local communities, a lot of it's mm-hmm. going to come from other places. So it's good to have this relationship between mm-hmm. public and private, where you have this ratcheting up, mm-hmm. leaning in, showing best practice, and then governments learning from that and say, okay, now how do we up the foundation so that everybody has to operate at that mm-hmm. level. And so I think there's definitely progress. The GBF, we're very pleased, elements, I mean, from the finance side, the GBF learned from the Paris Agreement in that you have this very important framing around the notion of alignment, where governments have parties to the convention say, we're going to work to align the financial system, public and private, with the objectives of the framework. And that's quite important to think about it once again. So if you think of a bank, it's not about what they do at the margins and put in their CSR report, which is important in itself, but what about their entire business? And are they able to understand the risks, the dependencies that they have in terms of their businesses on the pollinators mm-hmm. or on mm-hmm. you know, different natural assets? And what actions can we take? And so I guess my final point, once again, learning from action in the climate space, is this notion of transition plans. Hmm. Is this expectation for corporates. You talk about working with your supply chain mm-hmm. and helping them in terms of setting targets. You mm-hmm. yourself, I'm sure, are mm-hmm. very advanced in understanding what are the transitions you want to be contributing to, climate, biodiversity, water, etc. And then once we have a plan, we have targets, how do we deliver? So it's that sort of holistic approach that's needed. I think there's good progress being made, and I think the relationship between public and private is maturing in this direction as we speak.
Yeah.
And there's a great role for the, I think, for the private sector to play in both incentivizing and using a bit of a big stick. Yeah. You know, you talked about some of the, you know, the tuna issues. You have instances where those that are setting the quotas for tunas within those regions are saying, well, we're gonna set this really high, even though the data for the maximum sustainable yield, how much you're going to catch in years down here. Mm-hmm. Well, that's when those that are buying lots of tuna can lean in and say, you know what, we're going to stop buying from you because we feel that you're not listening to the science and dropping that down. And that's when it gets to this idea of knowledge and the importance of knowledge and making sure knowledge is accessible to local and community-based organizations mm-hmm. so they then can start making the decisions. We worked in Anguilla in 2016, and we helped them model the local trust there. We put data in their hands and said, what would a Category 5 hurricane look like coming through? And what are those weak points there? Mm-hmm. 2017, Hurricane Irma came through, and it proved the model exactly. Mm-hmm. It demonstrated very clearly those areas that were weak, where you remove mangroves, the sand dunes were no longer there, the seagrasses were gone, and it demonstrated quite clearly. And so what was the response? business went, well, we don't want to experience this again. We are going to plant mangroves. We're going to restore coral reefs. And of course, the insurance company steps in and says, okay, we're going to reduce your premiums because we know that healthy coral reefs absorb 95% wave energy. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some really interesting interplay between using the, okay, the big stick, but also incentives for nature. And I think there's a great role for business planning.
If I could pick up on that, one of the things we're seeing in the finance sector, and I think within the corporate community as well, is getting better at understanding the science. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in the past, it was a lot of it like, well, we shouldn't move because the policy's not there. I'll wait for the policy to come. And, you know, right now we're in a very complicated year in terms of understanding where the policy environment is going. But what we're learning is that if you understand the science, mm-hmm. if you can track the parts per million in the atmosphere, you know that eventually there's going to be a policy response. And there's actually a piece of research called the inevitable policy response, which essentially says...
That's it, folks. Tune in for another round of Biotech Beat, same time next week.
Every day you hear something new on CFRC. Can you keep up? You need a weekly recap.
You're listening
Catch
to
Catch Up with What's Climbing, Friday mornings at 10.